90% of the time, when a man or a woman is referring to her vagina, what she's really talking about is her vulva, because the vulva is everything on the outside. Anything that you can see, the vagina is an internal structure. And as a gynecologist, I get to see inside the vagina, but guys don't get to see inside the vagina, and neither do women for that matter. So it's a very important point in terms of language, because little girls are taught that it's just, first of all, they don't even get the normal anatomic language. They're taught down there or your privates. And then if they are taught something, they're generally taught that's your vagina, when in fact, it's the vulva.
Doctor's Guide to Men's Health. Each week on our podcast, we interview the top specialists of the field on various topics in men's health. You have questions that you are too afraid to ask, we have the answers. This week, our episode is titled Becoming Clitorate, Understanding the Female Anatomy and How to Best Pleasure Your Partner with Dr. Lauren Stryker. I'm Dr. Kevin Chu, and I'm joined as always with my co-host, Dr. Justin Dubin. Justin, how goes it in Florida, buddy?
It's good. You know, since we last spoke, my Giants lost. We're out.
So both the Steelers and Giants seasons are now officially
over. But listen, we were just not even close to as good as the Eagles, and we wouldn't be even close to as good as, you know, 49ers. Hey. The best four teams are in. The best four teams
right,
are in.
Right. But hey, look, that coach though, Brian Daboll. Yeah, dude, he's done a fantastic job turning that team around.
I'm very excited for the future.
They're gonna make some noise in the NFC. But hey, before we get started, before we jump in, why don't you give me your predictions for who's going to the Super Bowl and who's going to win it all?
Man, this is difficult. I'm thinking this week. I mean, I just hate the Eagles. I gotta go with San Fran. They're a great team. Like, I think the lines are very fair. I think they're all like -1, +1. Like, yeah, they're all there. It's very,
all very
close.
Equal teams. Yeah.
And I could honestly see any four of these teams win at all, which is rarely you can say. But I think I'm going to go San Francisco and the Bengals, because I just don't know with what's going on with Mahomes, whether he's truly healthy or not. Yeah. So yeah. I'm going to go with them. And I might say the Bengals might take it all. I don't know. They look good.
Joe Burrow. They look good. Joe Cool.
I'm very worried if the Eagles make it to the Super Bowl, I probably think they're going to just beat any team. But it's just, I think San Francisco can be the team to beat them. What do you think?
Gotcha. Well, I think on the AFC side, I like Mahomes, but this Bengals team is put together. And I think Joe Burrow's got some magic. So yeah. I think it's the Bengals coming out of the AFC. You know, I'm a little bit more unbiased, but this Jalen Hurts, they're throwing down so many points, and their defense is just like crushing teams. So
incredible.
I think it's very evenly matched. And apologies to my partners in my group who are all big 49ers fans, but I think the Eagles have it, and it's going to be a tough one. But I actually think the Eagles are going to take it this year.
Damn, terrible! I hate this. I hate it. I will be very sad. It was just like that.
That's me if the Bengals win.
Yeah,
you know?
It's true.
Like,
it's true. You can't. Yeah, I got you. Yeah. I got you. But back to what we're talking about. You know, this is like, I think we're this is coming out, you know, the last 2 days in January, but February coming up, you know, is a month for Valentine's Day, love. And, you know, we thought that we would highlight a lot of things with regards to, you know, female health and understanding women better. And the episode today, you know, Becoming Clitorate, I think is a really great way to kick off this month. And I think it's really great for a lot of guys to learn the female anatomy, because as Kevin and I have found out, I think a lot of people found out on these like TikToks and Instagrams, like guys don't know the female anatomy, but they also think that they can pleasure women. So explain that one to me, Kev. I don't know.
Well, you know, maybe some guys just think they, you know, they're just born with it and they got it. But look, you know, we're at a time where, you know, information is so readily available. And, you know, the more we understand, the better we can be, right?
Right.
And so learning just the foundation, learning, you know, the female pelvis, just learning anatomy, is going to take you so much further and, you know, an understanding when it comes to pleasure in women. So this was a great conversation with Dr. Stryker, and, you know, we learned a lot. And, you know, if there's one plug I want to put, you know, so listeners keep listening, for those guys who are like, nah, I don't need this, you know, look, we're going to learn a lot about lubricant.
Yeah.
Okay? You think it's just something that you buy off the shelf and you're good? No, there is so much more nuance and so much more understanding. So, you know, I thought it was a fabulous
episode. Yeah, it really was. And to give our listeners a little highlight of who Dr. Stryker is, you know, I met her when I was at Northwestern. She's become a mentor of mine. She is an OBGYN who specializes in menopause and sexual health. She's really a true master of women's sexual health. And she's also an Amazon best-selling author. She's writing books, including, you know, Sex RX and Slip Sliding Away. So, you know, we really have had a great time, and we really learned a lot from a specialist in this field. And like Kevin said, I think there's something to learn for everyone. And I thought that lube conversation at the end of this episode was really enlightening for a lot of people.
Very enlightening.
So enjoy the episode. I think this can make you a better partner, a better lover, and a better man, right? We're trying to elevate you, man up. So enjoy the episode.
All right. We are so lucky to be joined by Dr. Stryker. Thank you for coming on with us and, you know, helping us answer a couple questions that I know a lot of guys have. So let's just jump right in. First question. So let's do a little anatomy lesson for men. Now, this may sound like a really dumb question, but if you check online, there are a lot of TikToks, Instagram videos that show most guys don't really know the answer to this. But first question, what is the vagina?
Actually, that is an excellent question, not just for guys, but for women as well. Because 90% of the time when a man or a woman is referring to her vagina, what she's really talking about is her vulva. Because the vulva is everything on the outside, anything that you can see with the visual, with the naked eye or with taking a mirror and taking a look. The vagina is an internal structure. And as a gynecologist, I get to see inside the vagina, but guys don't get to see inside the vagina, and even the women for that matter. So it's a very important point in terms of language, because little girls are taught that it's just, first of all, they don't even get the normal anatomic language. They're taught down there or your privates. And then if they are taught something, they're generally taught that's your vagina, when in fact, it's the vulva.
Okay. So just to follow up with that, what does the vulva include? Like what is involved in the anatomy of the vulva here?
Well, let's start top to bottom. If we start at the top, we have the mons, where if someone doesn't remove their pubic hair, that's where the pubic hair is. And I do want to mention that it is normal to have varying amounts of pubic hair. Some people have very sparse pubic hair and some people have abundant pubic hair, and that's all normal. But of course, today less is more, and a lot of women are removing it, which doesn't have any health benefits. It's really a personal preference. And then as you move down, we have, going from outside to inside, we have the labia majora, which is Latin for the major labia, the large lips. And then we have the labia minora, which are the small lips. And just like with pubic hair, there is a lot of variation, and that variation is normal. Some women have very short labia. Some women have longer labia. They are very rarely perfectly symmetrical if you were to measure them, which we do sometimes. I don't think you do,
but
we do.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of variation. And then the clitoris is at the top. If you think of your vulva as a clock, at 12 o'clock is where the clitoris is. And it's buried underneath a little hood, which is called the prepuce. And the prepuce normally is like a garage door. It'll slide right past the clitoris to expose the clitoris. And again, it is perfectly normal to have varying sizes, but in general, clitoris is about the size of a Q-tip, bearing in mind that you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. The clitoris is a much larger structure than what's exposed. But as far as that little button, the little pea, the little part that you can see, that's about the size of a Q-tip. And then as you move down, you have the urethra, which is where the urine comes out. And then underneath that is what we call the introitus. And the introitus is the opening to the vagina, because again, the vagina is inside. You can't see the vagina, but you can see the opening, and that is known as the introitus. And then if you keep going south, then you're going to hit the anus.
It's so important because I think that a lot of people don't understand, especially when we're talking about vagina, vulva, urethra, that, you know, there's actually like two, first off, there's two holes, right? You know, women have, they pee out of one and then they can engage
Wait, Dr. Dubin, the three holes.
Three holes. Well, there's another hole.
Do you know
There's another hole. But
which one were you forgetting? That's what I want to know.
I'm not even going to. I think, three holes.
But I get your point, Justin. Though, like, you know, a lot of guys, I've had guys come in, they're like, wait, so girls, you know, where we have sex is not the same hole that they pee out of. Like, you know, that is confusing for some guys, you know?
It is. And you know, the other thing also is I don't do obstetrics anymore, but when I used to do obstetrics, and very often during labor, we would put a catheter in to empty the bladder. And women would say, well, if you put the catheter in, how's the baby going to come out? Right. Because, and we're talking educated women, and they, in their heads, it was the same opening. And in fact, it's not the same opening. So three openings, the urethra, the vagina, and then, of course, the anus.
The anus, yeah. No, but I meant like two holes in turn. I know
Okay. All right, I'll give you that.
I wasn't talking about the anus. I was talking in relation to the vagina, that area.
Well, you know, Justin, recently, you recently at the, you know, during our Basel, didn't you, there was like this display you saw of like all different types of, was it penises or vaginas?
No, it was the wall. It was technically, so that it was originally called the wall, the Great Wall of Vaginas. It was an art piece. I forgot the artist. It was at the Wien Museum here in Miami, but they actually changed it to the Great Wall of Vulva because of that, because it was not anatomically accurate in that description in the name. So yeah, that's a great point. But let's get back to, I think, the clitoris. And I think the clitoris is really important, obviously, for sexual satisfaction. For, you know, when we're talking with guys, I think a lot of guys don't really understand the clitoris. They don't understand the importance of the clitoris and its role in sexual health. So can you just tell us about the clitoris?
Well, you know, the clitoris, if we go all the way back to before we were born embryologically, I like to think of the penis as being a large clitoris, as opposed to the clitoris being a small penis, which is how some people, but as a gynecologist, my point of reference is the penis is a large clitoris. And to that point, the clitoris is really the organ of orgasm. And that is one of the greatest misconceptions for both men and women, that there's this expectation that a woman is going to orgasm from penetrative sex. And in fact, that is rarely the case. We're talking maybe 10 to 15% of time. There needs to be clitoral stimulation in order for a woman to have an orgasm. And there's a lot of ways that can happen. Of course, it can happen. It can happen during penetration in some cases. It's a little bit more difficult, but it can happen. And then, of course, with direct stimulation, either manually with fingers or with a tongue or with a vibrator. But what we know is that for orgasm to occur, in most cases, there has to be, number one, arousal, and number two, clitoral stimulation. And without that, it's unlikely to happen. And that's actually one of the big mysteries, because I do an event every year at Kellogg School of Business for men. And basically, my daughter, who's a sex therapist, and I think you had her.
She's been on the show. Yeah, great episode.
And so Rachel and I do that together. And we take questions from the men. And that is one of the most common questions we get, is how can I make sure that my female partner has an orgasm, because they're kind of mystified why it's not happening during penetrative sex.
I think the way that you phrase it is very interesting and important for guys. If you think of the clitoris as the female penis in many ways, I think guys, obviously, when we're aroused and we want to engage in sex, we think about being stimulated through our penis. So if we think about it that way, and we say, hey, I want to stimulate my partner, I want my female partner to orgasm, I should stimulate their penis, which is their clitoris. So if you think about it that way, I think it kind of makes a lot of sense for guys to more or less dumb it down in that capacity, how I'm trying to translate it.
No, and in defense of guys, I don't know that that's dumbing it down. I think, you know, part of the problem is that female anatomy, female genitalia is quite frankly a mystery, not only to women, but to men. And part of it is because there's the shame from when you're kids and parents don't necessarily talk about it. But the other is that it's hidden. You know, a penis, it's kind of hard to not be able to see it if you're a guy. It's right there.
Sometimes.
You can inspect it all day long if you want. But for women, it's a lot more challenging. And so not only do women not really have a clear understanding of their anatomy and their clitoris, but then very often male partners don't either, because, you know, it's not like they can get a good look. And it's not as if someone has shown them the way. And in fact, I'm trying to remember who did it. It was one of these things, like a man on the street thing, where they basically had a diagram and they said, you know, point to where the clitoris is and other parts of female genitalia. And I think about 90% of men were completely clueless. They had absolutely no idea. So if they can't tell where to go with a giant diagram, you know, they sure don't know where to go when they've had two glasses of wine, it's dark.
Yes.
And they're in the throes of passion, you know, it's like, okay, whatever, you know, and that's, you know, one of the things I would encourage men to do is, quite frankly, when you're not with your partner, if you have a female partner, if you're not with your partner, get out a diagram. They're easy enough to find and figure out where everything is.
The internet is a wonderful place and you'll be able to find these diagrams everywhere. And one of the things is, I think some guys may get mixed up with terminology and they think G-spot, you know, is this a real thing? You know, is this the clitoris? You know, some guys, you know, you've seen that on the internet. So what is the G-spot? Is it real?
Well, this is what you need to know about the G-spot. You know, I mentioned that the clitoris that you can see is the external part, the tip of the iceberg. But I'm looking around because normally I have a clitoris model here, but I just,
oh, that's cool.
It didn't come prepared because I just moved. I think I mentioned.
See, sometimes even clitoris. Dr. Oh, Stryker can't find the clitoris sometimes.
Yeah. Wait, give me 2 seconds. Okay. Never mind. Maybe I'll remember where I put it. Anyway, the point is that the clitoris, aside from the tip of it, there's wings that come down and then there's a portion that goes back. So the G-spot, which is named after Dr. Graffenberg, who first described it, is an area in the roof of the vagina. So again, we're talking internally, about a third of the way back in the roof of the vagina. And for some people, this is a very sensitive area. And the question always was, is this a separate thing from the clitoris, or is this part of the clitoris?
Right.
And now the feeling is that it really is an extension of the clitoris. And some people, like, it's like hunting for buried treasure. They're like so obsessed with finding the G-spot. It's like, oh my God, stop looking for the G-spot. If someone has a sensitive G-spot and that's pleasurable to them, great, go for it. But this is not where you should be focusing your attention.
Okay,
focus
that's important.
Focus your attention on the clitoris.
So, I mean, in that regard, so it sounds to me like a big part of this, and obviously guys, we stink at this a lot of the times, is communication. So, you know, if a guy is struggling or they want to please their female partner, and obviously we're talking here, you know, in a male-female relationship, what's a good way of approaching that situation? Like, hey, you know, how do I communicate my desire without feeling embarrassed? Is there a good way of approaching your partner, saying like, hey, I want to hit your G-spot, or let me help me find the clitoris on you, or like, where is a good spot that pleases you?
I mean, I think it's really simple. It's basically just saying, I want to give you pleasure. What's pleasurable for you? And I think the other thing that's important to know about the clitoris that we didn't really get into is the nerves in the clitoris.
Mm, yes.
We used to say there were 8,000 nerve endings. Now we know it's closer to 10,000.
Right.
More is not necessarily better. I'm, you know, one of the few people who can been out there publicly talking about that. Everyone's like, oh my God, this is so great. There's 10,000 nerve endings. And I'm thinking, no, that means they're even smaller than we thought they were. These are teeny, teeny, tiny little nerve endings. And sometimes small nerve endings are not as sensitive, especially as women age, or if they have medical problems such as diabetes or multiple sclerosis. Those nerve endings are already challenged. And when they're, the smaller they are, the harder it is to get them to trigger. So, but there are a lot of little nerve endings. But the interesting thing about the nerve endings in the clitoris is that there's different types of receptors, and they respond to pressure, they respond to light touch, and they respond to vibration. And those are three different types. And women will tell you what they like. They're going to tell you, I do better with light pressure, which could either be manual or with a tongue, or they like the firmer pressure, the deeper pressure. These are the Pacinian corpuscles are the ones that are firing. And you got to press a little harder. And for some women, that gives them pleasure. And then vibration, of course, everybody likes vibration, right? But the thing about vibration that's interesting is the last to go. So again, if someone has a partner who is not 20, who's on the other end of 40, 50, 60, and if they're having difficulty orgasming and they're frustrated, then you go right for the gold. You go right for the vibrator because the vibration nerve receptors last longer than any others, which is why, quite frankly, many women are only able to orgasm with vibration. But to your point, the woman's going to know that. You know, she's going to have been trying it on her own, and she's going to, you know that maybe the only way that she has an orgasm is with vibration, and she's kind of shy to mention that. So a guy can come right out and say, hey, I've got a vibrator. Is that fun for you? Is that pleasurable for you? Instead of saying, do you use a vibrator? Say, when you use your vibrator, does it give you pleasure? That's normalizing it. As opposed to saying, hey, do you need a vibrator? Makes her feel like, oh, I don't really want to admit that I need the vibrator. You just say, hey, when you use your vibrator, do you like that? Because I've got one. Let's go for it. You know, and you just make it everything. It's fun. It's supposed to be fun, right?
Gotcha. I'm going to go back to a point that you just kind of made. And it reminds me of a few patients I've actually seen recently. So, you know, women, when they start hitting menopause and go postmenopause, the clitoris is undergoing changes then, I guess, right? You're less, the nerve endings aren't, as you're saying, like, you know, are responding to different things. And that's kind of an important thing to consider.
Right. Well, there's two things that are going on when someone enters menopause. One is, of course, their estrogen levels are pretty much on empty. And estrogen does a couple of things. Number one, it does increase the sensitivity, but it also increases blood flow. Estrogen is a vasodilator. And it is so important, whether we're talking penis or we're talking clitoris, that you have good blood flow. You spend half your life talking about blood flow.
Absolutely.
To the penis. It's the same thing. So you lose your blood flow, and that's a problem. And the other thing that happens is the normal changes that you see with aging. You're going to have vascular changes, particularly someone who has heart disease or diabetes. And 50% of women who are in their 50s and 60s do have one of those medical conditions. So the combination of those two things can cause there to be significant decreased blood flow to the clitoris, which is going to make it less sensitive. Why? Because you have 10,000 teeny tiny little nerve endings that are dependent on blood flow to be healthy. So when we are trying to help women, what's the first thing we're going to do? We're going to increase blood flow. How do we do that? Well, first of all, the more arousal, the better. You know, stimulation is certainly going to increase blood flow. But the second is that we use topical estrogen, which is going to be a vasodilator. We use some other products as well. Sometimes we use a little CBD oil. You know, there's all kinds of tricks. Now, of course, the obvious question for you, that you know the answer to this already, but the women ask is, what about Viagra? You know, Viagra works great for the guys. How about for the women? And there have not been nearly as many studies in women as in men. And it's very inconsistent. We know that in certain circumstances, such as women who have multiple sclerosis or diabetes, Viagra does seem to work. But the number one circumstance in which we see the most benefit with Viagra are women who are not able to orgasm because of their SSRI, because of their antidepressant.
Yes, we see that in men. We see that in men all the time.
Same
as well.
Thing. And that's one of the, you know, when we talk about, we were talking about women who are a little bit older, but if you were to say, okay, well, what about the 30-year-old woman or the 40-year-old woman who's having a hard time having an orgasm with clitoral stimulation and arousal and, you know, someone, a partner that she likes? And the first thing we're going to look at is she taking an SSRI? Because very often that's the culprit. And sometimes we can change it around a little bit, but we do use Viagra in those situations. And then the other thing that we didn't really talk about, but I think it is certainly worth mentioning, is there's a big difference between a woman who's never had an orgasm and a woman who used to have orgasms just fine, and then something changes.
Right, that makes sense.
You know, a primary inability to have an orgasm versus acquired. And they're very, very different. And with young women, 20s, 30s, early 40s, in almost every single case of someone who has a primary, meaning they've never had an orgasm, it's because they don't know their anatomy. They haven't been told that they need clitoral stimulation. Sometimes it's just an education. Now, sometimes it's they have a history of trauma or abuse, and we know that that has a very, very high correlation with not being able to have an orgasm. We also know that pain, if a woman, and guys need to know this, because first of all, pain is never normal. Never, never, never. And there's no such thing as, okay, just grit your teeth and bear it. If a woman is having pain, it is not okay, even if she says keep going, because she's feeling guilty or she's feeling badly, it's not a good thing. And it will only make the pain worse because her pelvic floor muscles will tighten up. And if someone is having pain, it's pretty much a guarantee that she's not going to have, she's not going to have an orgasm. And particularly in young women, one of the more common situations in which we see that is endometriosis.
Right.
And a lot of women with severe endometriosis have terrible pain with penetrative sex. And until that gets fixed, you know, it's going to be a huge challenge.
So it sounds like, you know, to summarize this, it sounds like although women anatomically maybe seem different, but they have the same potential complications as men. I think that female sexual health is a bit more complicated than men. Maybe I'm a little biased because Kevin and I do know the male side so much better. But I mean, listen, when we talk with our patients, we talk about hormone levels, we talk about blood flow, we talk about nerve injuries, we talk about, you know, being aroused. We talk about, you know, antidepressants and depression and anxiety. These are all things that impact not just men, but women. So it's important, you know, guys, you understand sometimes what you're going through. So you have to understand the other side as well. And you know, we're all human and we're all susceptible to the same things. And it really reflects the idea. Sexual health is health on both sides of the spectrum.
Absolutely. And I will say the one factor that you're going to see in women that, correct me if I'm wrong, that you really don't see in men very often is pain, the pain issue. Yeah. And, you know, men, if they're having difficulty, it's usually with their ability to function, whether it's that they can't maintain an erection or are premature, you know, all the things that you always talk about. But it's pretty rare that you have a guy that has pain with penetrative sex, correct?
Pain with orgasm. More. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not common. You know, it's not one of the common things that you see. Whereas with women, pain with penetrative sex is unfortunately not uncommon at all. And it's very treatable. And that's, you know, one of my frustrations is that we see women all the time. Yeah, I've been running a sexual medicine clinic for the last 6 years, and we're very often the 8th, 9th, 10th opinion from a woman who's found her way to us on her own because she's been having pain and no one has been able to help her. Or they say things like, oh, just drink wine or go see a therapist and relax, when in fact they have a physical problem that's causing the pain, which is in almost every single case treatable. So, you know, another thing for the men particularly who are listening is if you have a female partner who is having pain and she says, you know, I talked to my gynecologist and they weren't able to help me, then the message is go see someone else. There are people who specialize in this, who do sexual medicine, just like you do sexual medicine for men. There are people that do sexual medicine for women who can help with pain, but pain is never okay, never. And it is very treatable.
That's very good to know. And it's good for our listeners to kind of, you know, understand that there are a lot of resources. Just like Dr. Strike said, there's male sexual medicine doctors and as well as female sexual medicine doctors, and that's really important.
Absolutely.
Now let's kind of go back. So we've been talking a lot about the similarities between, you know, male and females. Why don't we talk about the differences between male and female orgasms? Yeah. Are there differences, similarities?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly there are similarities that we've already talked about in that there needs to be arousal to have an orgasm on either side. There needs to be blood flow and there generally needs to be stimulation. Not always, but I think that's true for both men and women. People can think their way to orgasm and have been doing so since the beginning of time. So there doesn't always have to be physical stimulation. It just certainly helps. The difference is that And, you know, again, I'm not an expert in men. I'm a gynecologist.
We're here for that. Don't worry.
You're there for that. Not for women. But for women, there really does need to be a significant arousal phase in order for them to orgasm. And I don't know if that's the case as much for men. And women are also ready to go quicker for round number two or round number three. That, you know, kind of resolution afterwards can be a lot shorter for women, and they can have multiple orgasms, which men generally cannot. I mean, the other difference is that women, as I mentioned, respond very well to vibration. And men, certainly I've been told that men, some men enjoy penis vibration at the base of the penis or at the tip of the penis, but I don't know that that's the same, as you're going to see.
Interesting for spinal cord patients. We do use vibratory stimulation to get them to get erect and orgasm. So that is some innate, nerve thing with, with the nerves. But about the female orgasm, I think the interesting thing here is, you do need stimulation. How, guys, for the most part, we see guys because they often come in complaining that they last too short. And I think a lot of that is almost the opposite spectrum of women. And I will get into the orgasm gap, I think, in a little bit. But I do think it's important that we understand how long on average does it take for a woman to reach climax and to achieve an orgasm? Because, I think there's this idea, first off, like, penetrative sex isn't the only form of sex, which is obviously something we need to get into. But, and that kind of leads from this idea that, of how long it really takes to get a female to orgasm or climax.
Yeah. And it's highly variable. I mean, certainly it really depends on how aroused somebody is, how sensitive their nerve endings are, how they're stimulated. We know that most women, if they're stimulated with a vibrator, are going to orgasm much more quickly than with other ways. But, when we talk about arousal, and I think this is such an important point to make is, and you have not used this term, but the term that's used a lot is foreplay. How long should you have foreplay? And foreplay is something that I and a lot of other female sexual medicine experts would like to see eliminated from our terminology because it implies that foreplay is just leading up to the main event. And, as you said, intercourse is not the only kind of sex. You can have great sex without ask any lesbians, gay women have great sex. And they don't have penetrative sex unless they're using toys. And they don't think of what they're doing as foreplay. They're having sex.
Right.
So, but it's this idea of intercourse has to be the grand finale and everything else is foreplay. No. I know you're very familiar with Ian Kerner's book, She Comes First, and the whole notion, I'm sure you've talked about it, the idea is that, she can come first because that is going to be her sexual pleasure, but it's not foreplay, that's sex. And for men as well, men can have pleasure without having penetrative sex. So I think that's just kind of a paradigm shift in terms of how we think about it.
Yeah. Now, go ahead, Kev.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. Eliminating the word foreplay, because I think it's so common in our vocabulary, and I think you set the stage very right. That I think many guys do see that as like, hey, that is just leading to the main event in many ways.
Well, it's male centric, is what it is.
Right.
It's 100%. The main event is for the man to have intercourse and have an orgasm, and everything else is foreplay.
I mean, that leads us to this idea of this orgasm gap. Can you explain to us what the orgasm gap is? Because I think a lot of guys don't know this.
There's been a lot written about it, of course, particularly more recently. And I have a podcast as well, Dr. Stryker's Inside Information. And I had a recent episode on the orgasm gap that I interviewed Dr. Lori Mintz, who you probably know because she wrote a wonderful book called Becoming Clitorate. And basically, it's about the orgasm gap, the idea that men are, from a very young age, taught to expect that they should have sexual pleasure and they should have an orgasm, and they generally have satisfying sexual encounters from when the time that they start having sex. Whereas women are not taught that they should have an orgasm or that they should necessarily have pleasure, and very often don't have orgasms. And there are women that will go through their entire life without having an orgasm. They don't know how, They don't know that that's not normal. And there's this enormous gap, not only in what men and women are experiencing, but really about expectations, culture, and societal views on in terms of, you know, what's okay. You know, should women feel ashamed if they don't have an orgasm and want one? You know, that's the thing. They're almost taught like, oh, honey, you know, you're not supposed to expect to have an orgasm. Mm. That's just lie back and, you know, endure and let him Damn. Have his fun. And I think we're getting away from that, but we still certainly do have an orgasm gap.
So what do you think the best way is to approach this to kind of help, you know, improve?
Great question.
Well, you know, in a perfect world, we would approach it with sex education from a very young age. But that's a big problem in this country mm-hmm. because sex education Absolutely. Is not only limited, but it's becoming more limited. And if you look at what most kids get, what the girls are taught about sex is how not to get a sexually transmitted infection and how not to get pregnant right. at best. They are never taught about having pleasure. Mm. And that's not part of sex ed. So, you know, it starts with anatomy. I mean, circling back to our very, very first conversation is that, you know, girls need to be taught that they have a vulva, that these are the parts of the vulva. Let's identify those parts. The clitoris is for pleasure. You know, no one is doing that. And if you start with that, you're going to go a long way. And I remember there was a book that came out, Lori Ornstein's book on girls and sex, which also is about the orgasm gap. She's a New York Times writer. It's an excellent book if you haven't read it. And basically, again, the socialization of how boys have an expectation of pleasure and girls don't. And she wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about how important it is for mothers to teach their daughters about how to have pleasure. So I wrote a letter to the editor, which got published, that said, yeah, but first someone's got to teach the mothers.
And that's a great point. That's a great point.
Is that, you know, it gets carried down because, you know, we say, okay, well, hey, moms, teach your daughters. But we have adult women that no one has ever taught them. So it's very challenging.
So that sounds like it's very difficult for guys too, obviously. We still, as guys, you know, I think a lot of guys, they talk about how they enjoy getting their partner off, but right. it sounds like we're not succeeding. In our minds, we may. And I think that's where I'm going with this next. Like, how do we know? Should we ask? Like, how do we approach that idea of is my partner faking it? And should I be concerned? Is this a problem? Like, what
there's
I need to do?
There's a good chance she is faking it. and one of the things when we look at, there was a study that was done. I forgot where it was done, but anyway, it came out about 10 years ago or so. And they interviewed all these couples and they said to the woman, how often do you fake orgasm? And in this group, I think like 30 or 40% said, oh, I, you know, fake it at least some of the time. And then they asked their male partners, how often does your female partner fake orgasm? And they said, never. And so what that tells me is that the women were really good actresses.
No, I think we're just so thick-headed that we think we're the man is probably more of it.
But you say, okay, well, why would a woman fake it? Well, there's a lot of reasons why a woman would fake it. One is because she feels like a failure. She's like, what's wrong with me that I can't have an orgasm? Mm. So I'm going to pretend that so that I don't look like I'm a sexual failure. The second is she just wants him to stop trying already so she can go to sleep. Because she knows it's not going to happen. And the other is to please him. Because as you said, we are all aroused by our partner being aroused.
Correct.
And that goes both ways. You know, women love it when their guy's excited and guys love it when women are excited. And one of the ways to be excited if you're a woman is to pretend that you're having an orgasm. So there's a phrase that's used in research actually called an SSE, a satisfying sexual experience, as opposed to orgasm. And I think that we need to think in terms more of not did you have an orgasm, but is this good for you? You know, are you enjoying this? Is there something else, you know, do you want, is there something else I can do? Or, you know, I think you have to make it acceptable to not have an orgasm, and it could still be a good sexual experience.
But are you saying that's just for women, or like, you know, it's like, or is that for men too? You know, like, is it, that's a weird question to ask, like after sex, like, oh, that was great. Like, did you enjoy that just as much? Like, you know, like, how do you come to that conclusion in a natural setting? Like, maybe not during the encounter, but how do you approach that? Right. Because like a satisfying, like, I don't want to hear from my partner, yeah, that was enjoyable, but I didn't orgasm. Like, I want to have you experience the way that I experience sex in an it's kind of an interesting way to look at it, but you shouldn't look at that as a failure as a guy in a way. Do you see what I'm saying there?
No. I mean, let's put it this way. If she never has an orgasm and you're not figuring out what you need to do, then that's an issue and you need to figure that out. But sometimes there's just going to be days when it's just not going to happen.
Right.
And give up, give it up, you know, and say, okay, you know what, this was nice. And I think part of the problem also is that if someone is having difficulty with orgasm for whatever reason, or if they're having difficulty having penetrative sex, you know, for all the reasons you know, then I think sometimes they avoid any sexuality altogether, any physical touching, because it's like, well, what's the point? If I can't have an orgasm, if he can't have an orgasm, why get naked and touch each other and kiss? And I think that that's, again, the paradigm that we have to change, is that even if for some reason the man or the woman is not going to have an orgasm that particular time for whatever reason, it doesn't mean that they still can't be sexual and they can't have pleasure and they can't enjoy each other's bodies and being with each other. And again, putting all this value on orgasm, that's why people fake it. Because they think, well, you know, if I don't say I had it, then this whole thing was a failure. And it's the whole idea of saying, no, it's not a failure. Maybe it wasn't as great as you hoped for it to be. I mean, it's kind of like, you know,
you're not going to bat 100. You're not going to bat 100.
It's going to be the most amazing wine on earth, and it's not, but it's still good wine. You're so glad you're drinking it, you know?
That's good analogy. It's a very good analogy. Yeah, no, it's interesting to me. It's just like one of those things also, like if a guy, and this kind of leads up to this other idea that a man orgasming doesn't mean that the sexual encounter has to end as well, right? I mean, like, I think a lot of guys, when they come and they orgasm, they think that's the end of sexual activity. How do we train guys to be more considered? Because obviously, you know, when we're younger, we can turn over faster, but there's a longer period for guys.
Right. But that's, again, the whole concept of, you know, eliminating the concept of foreplay is the lead up to the guy having an orgasm, and then we're done. And that's also the whole premise of Ian Kerner's book, you know, She Comes First, saying, make sure that the woman has an orgasm first, and then the guy can have his orgasm, and then you're both done. Because you are absolutely correct in that most guys, once they've had their orgasm, they're done. They are done, done, done.
It's a problem. A lot of things that, you know, I think need to be worked on, you know, in this space, especially for guys and, you know, just the way.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you don't want it to seem like a big burden. I mean, I don't want people to come with me saying, oh my God, this sounds so hard. This is like so impossible. I mean, I really think that it comes down to two things. It comes down to, it would be helpful if you know your anatomy and appreciate the fact that clitoral stimulation is really important. But then it also comes down, it's like, and this is the theme that you return to again and again and again, it's communication.
Absolutely.
What does your partner enjoy? You know, is your partner having the experience that they want to have? And the only way to know that is, you know, to talk. You know, one of the things that's interesting is I do a bunch of surveys for a variety of reasons. And one of the surveys that I did was biggest bedroom turnoffs. And I did one for men and I did one for women. And the one for men, the biggest turnoff, do you want to guess what it was? The number one biggest bedroom turnoff?
For men.
Talking too
for
much?
For men.
Too much talking, he said. I have no idea. I don't know.
Hygiene. hygiene.
That makes sense.
Not good hygiene was biggest bedroom. But number two was the opposite of not enough talking, is that men don't like it when a woman just lies there and makes no noise. They want some kind of feedback, whether it's, you know, moaning, groaning, this is wonderful, move to the right. The guys don't want to feel like they are making love to an inanimate object who's just lying there and saying, get over it already.
That's what we have porn for, right? It's true.
So take a shower and give them some feedback and it's all good. Right?
Well, now tell us what the results for the girls. What's the biggest turnoff in the bedroom for girls? This is a men's health podcast. Hygiene
was number one. And we're talking toenails rated really high.
Mani pedis. Gotta get mani pedis.
I agree. You know, gotta do something with those toenails. Teeth is critically important. I mean, aside from just being clean and all that kind of stuff.
Teeth goes hand in hand with hygiene in my book for me and my brain.
Women do not respond well, to bad teeth. And then there's the streaks on his underwear. I'm just saying.
Oh my God.
Guys, got a lot of work. Got a lot of work.
The survey doesn't lie.
And honestly, I wish I could say, like, that's like low hanging fruit. That's like one that I've never even thought of. You know, like, you can't even fault anyone for that one. That one's just terrible. Like, what are we doing here?
Well, it must be more common than I thought, because it was enough that I got a lot of responses. Yeah, these surveys are fun. I learn a lot from them. I did a survey along the same lines. I think it was the same survey about preferred pubic hairstyles.
And what was the answer here?
Majority of men. So that was multiple choice, and it was either full bush, trimmed, completely bare, or I don't care, I'm just happy to be invited to the party. Yeah. And it was, I don't care, I'm just happy to be invited to the
that's
party.
That's men looking at women. That's men looking at women. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. I think that no one's going to stop for guys.
And then I asked, do you think your partner's labia are too long? And so the first choice was, no, they're perfect. The second was, yes, I wish they were shorter. And the third was, what's a labia?
I'm sure that was the answer. Or if you put fourth, who cares? Happy to be here. Someone would have just said that, probably.
That's a guy.
Probably. You know what? Actually, that was there. Yeah, that was the most popular. Yeah, I've never published that stuff.
Did you do the pubic hair for girls for guys?
Yes, I would like to know the answer.
You know what? I did not. And it's interesting because years ago, manscaping was not something that guys did, and now you see a lot more of it. And the whole pubic hair thing is really interesting. I just did a podcast on vulvar vanity and kind of did the deep dive in the whole pubic hair thing. And a lot of people think that there's a health benefit to removing the hair. And in fact, it's quite the opposite. There's biologic reasons that we have pubic hair, aside from it being a cushion and decreasing friction and providing lubrication. It also provides genital warmth, which is going to increase blood flow. So there's really no benefit to removing pubic hair, but certainly that's what people are doing.
Interesting.
On that idea of lubrication, we're going to go on a little bit of a tangent. All right. Idea of lubrication. Now, you know, people watch porn, and in some porn videos, you see that women squirt, right? And so, you know, I think this is a, you know, this idea in men that women can squirt. So is, you know, why do some women squirt when they orgasm? What are they squirting? What is the fluid?
Yeah. It's a million-dollar question, because it's actually quite controversial when someone squirts. Is this a small amount of urine coming out? Is this, there's some little glands next to the urethra called the Skene's glands. Right. Are they overdeveloped? And is there some squirting coming from there? All I have to say about squirting, quite frankly, is some women squirt, some women don't. It's normal if you squirt. It's normal if you don't. Occasionally, I'll have someone that'll say to me, I'd like to squirt. How do I do that? And I have no idea.
But that's important to hear, right? That's important for people. Like, guys don't understand that. It's a complicated thing.
But it's also, I think most important, it's not an indication of excitement or satisfaction. So that the idea is, if she doesn't squirt, does it, you know, does that mean that she didn't have an orgasm? No, most women do not squirt. They don't. And it has, you know, it can happen with orgasm, but it is certainly not part of the orgasm expectation.
But that's also the same with like girls getting, you know, like natural lubricant is different from squirting, correct? Like if when you're wet.
Of vaginal lubrication comes from the vaginal walls. Right. And it's one of the major things that we see happen in women who are postmenopause, of course, is that they, about 70 to 80% of women lose the ability to lubricate, which is what causes dryness and pain. And of course, that's completely treatable. But even young women, there's a lot of reasons why someone may be dry that has nothing to do with menopause. The most common, quite frankly, is someone's just not aroused, you know, that they're just not into it. But also we can see it with various medications. We see it with young women when they're postpartum, when they're nursing. You know, there's a lot of circumstances in which someone is not lubricated. And I think pretty much anyone at some point is going to need to use a commercial lubricant product to help things along, and they shouldn't feel badly about that. And I will say that we could spend a whole hour talking about lubricants, but I'll just say one sentence. If it has KY in the name, don't put it anywhere near your vagina, because it is toxic. KY jelly is a very high osmolality and actually eats away at vaginal mucosa and increases not only the risk of having pain, but also increases the risk of acquiring a sexually transmitted infection because of breaking down the vaginal mucosa. So,
Justin, I did not know that. Did you know that?
I had no. I just thought. Wow. We don't know anything about lubes. Obviously, you're the. I know that you are a master of lubricant information.
Right. Well, so this is the thing. I mean, guys need to know about lubes, because a lot of times it's the guy that supplies the lube, and he's, you know, and it's great that the guy is being thoughtful and goes to the store and then buys something really horrible, like, you know, KY warming jelly, which is the worst of them, thinking that this is going to be a positive
experience. No idea.
I mean, just to give you an idea, and we can go on about this for hours, and I don't want to bore everybody. Right. But
this is interesting. This is not
very interesting.
Well, okay, so the osmolality, which means how many particles are dissolved in something. So water has an osmolality of 0, okay? So the normal osmolality in the vagina is 300, and you want anything you put in the vagina to be around 300 in order to maintain healthy vaginal mucosa. So the World Health Organization has come out and said that you should not use a lubricant that has an osmolality. Ideally, you know, keep it under 1,000, but the closer to 300, the better. KY warming jelly is 10,000.
Whoa.
Okay. And the reason, and you say, well, why does the WHO care? The World Health Organization, why do they care? Do they care about pleasurable sex? No. Do they care about dry vaginas? No. Do they care about women? No. What they do care about is HIV. And that's why all these studies were done with osmolality, and how we know that it breaks down vaginal mucosa. So that's why the World Health Organization got involved and said, you have to be very careful. So to keep it real simple, men, if you are going to show up with a lubricant, thank you, get a silicone lubricant, not a water-based lubricant. Silicone lubricants are slippier, they last longer, and there are no osmolality or pH issues. Water-based lubricants, there are good ones, but you got to search for them. I have a book called Slip Sliding Away, Turning Back the Clock on Your Vagina, that has an entire chapter on this. Uh-huh. I have a podcast episode that I have a ton of men who've listened to it, by the way. I look at my analytics and I've got 30, 40% men listen.
That's great.
And my one on is your, I think it's called, Is Your Lubricant Helping or Hurting Your Vagina? Something like that. And it goes through the whole song and dance on lubricants. But if you don't want to listen to that or read the book, just go get yourself a silicone lubricant. Replenz Silky Smooth is one. There's a whole bunch of them out there. And they're great. They're far more slippery anyway. And they also make nice massage oils, just saying.
Ooh. So are there silicone-based, like, scented ones? Like, stay away from all of that? You want plain?
Stay away, because the scented lube. Stuff, anything that increases scent is going to increase osmolality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's fine in a pinch. You know, once in a while, if you got to use whatever is handy, great. But if you're using it on a regular basis, and also just to be clear, silicone lubricants are condom compatible. as our water-based lubricants. Oil-based lubricants, a lot of people go for coconut oil and all that stuff. Not condom compatible. We'll eat away the condom. Oh. They're generally not slippery enough anyway. But again, if you don't care about the condom, okay in a pinch, but you don't want to use, I always say if it's using it for making lunch, you don't want to use it for making love. Do not head down to the kitchen for your lubricants.
Wait, can we?
Baby oil, same thing. Baby oil is going to eat away the condom.
What do you mean eating away the condom? Maybe you just elaborate on that. Like, I'm a,
it's not latex compatible. It'll break down the latex.
Oh.
Yeah, silicone lubricants and water-based lubricants are condom compatible. Okay. Oil-based lubricants are not condom compatible.
So you can literally, it can literally during intercourse just help it tear or like dissolve?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
it'll tear. It'll tear. And so when you're thinking in terms of not only pregnancy, but STI protection, you want to stay away from the, from coconut oil and all that stuff.
But in non-condom, is coconut oil okay? And like pure, like, you know, you're in a relationship,
there's
long-term relationship.
There's one study that shows that it increased the risk of bacterial vaginosis, which is a common cause of discharge, irritation, and odor in women. Again, you know, once in a blue moon, it's fine. I wouldn't use it on a regular basis. But the main thing is it's very thin. You know, it really, I mean, if you take coconut oil and you put it between your hands and you rub, give it about 30 seconds, it's going to feel kind of gritty, right?
Yeah.
That's the test. If you put some silicone lube between your hands and you rub, it's going to stay slippery. Mm. Same with water. A lot of guys, or saliva, you know, spit on your hands and keep rubbing. It's not going to be so slippery in about 10 seconds. So you have to think about that. That's the test. Put it between your hands and rub. And after 10 seconds, if it's not slippery anymore, you don't want to put it in the vagina.
This is great info, because I'll tell you, I don't know if the branding, the advertising, but like, I think Justin can attest, most guys out of high school, you know, you're brought up, you're like, oh, KY, that's the lubricant you need, right?
Right, yeah, you're 100% right, 100% right. Because it's the advertise. Well, they advertise better than anyone, yeah.
Yes, it's the most sold lubricant. And a lot of times when we would see people in the clinic who were having irritation and pain, that's, you know, on our, we would do this pre-screener when they come to the clinic, and that was on the list of, do you use a lubricant? Yeah. What kind of lubricant do you use? And sometimes just changing them to a different lubricant, game changer, completely changed everything. But people don't know that. You know, my slip sliding away book, it's amazing how well it does. The sales have really exceeded my expectations because people are not given this information. The other thing that's so interesting to me is on YouTube, I have a lot of YouTube videos. There's one video that I almost didn't post it because I thought it was so stupid, and it's really short and it's not even well done, but it's how to use a lubricant. It's exploded.
Can you tell us? Can you tell us how to use a lubricant?
How you actually, I mean, I sit there and say, open the bottle, put it on your fingers, put it on his penis, put it at the opening of her vagina. And it's about 90% viewed by men who know that they need to use a lubricant, but once they get that bottle, they don't know what the heck to do with it, and they don't know how it's going to get inside her vagina. And I talk about lube shooters and all that kind of stuff. So that stupid little video does very, very well. I included it in one of my
things. It's one of those things that
but we forget,
are so simple.
You know, that
yeah.
It's not stupid. It's, I always say that, you know, every single other thing we do, they give you these ridiculously detailed instructions, like when you buy your shampoo and they say, squirt a little bit in your hand and put it on your hair and rub and then rinse it out. And you're like, okay, I got it. Yeah. But then you get the lube and nobody tells you where to put it. So it's not so stupid.
That was very enlightening. I think I definitely learned a lot about, you know, lube because, you know, who teaches us? Only you. like literally only you. And that's why we're so happy you've come on because, you know, how else are we going to get these kinds of answers? I don't think.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the thing is, guys, because unfortunately, the way that you've put it into these terms is guys aren't going to be as impacted on it, except for the condom thing, obviously, potentially. But, you know, I don't want to damage my partner's vagina with a bad lube, but I wouldn't have known that. Because who am I asking, right? So like, these are just very interesting things to be very thoughtful. And it's not like, you know, I think it's just small things that can really make a difference for your partner's sexual satisfaction.
Well, that's exactly it. And you know, as we keep circling back to, at the end of the day, if you're in a relationship, you both want it to be a positive sexual mm-hmm. experience. And there's a lot of different ways you can make that happen. And sometimes the smallest things make the biggest difference.
So on that note, to kind of wrap it up, any final tips or tricks for guys to really be better lovers for their partners?
I think, you know, and I know I keep saying the same thing again and again, but it really does come down to know her anatomy and communicate, because she will tell you what she likes if you ask her. And I have a number of books that I've written, and while they are directed at women, I have found that when couples read them together, it gets the conversation going. And the same with my podcasts. I have so many couples that listen to my podcast in the car, they'll turn it on. And this is a nice way to communicate these kinds of things, because these can be hard conversations to start. And when, you know, you say, oh, I just read in this book about how, you know, women love these couples' vibrators, and would, you know, wouldn't that be fun to try something like that? For some reason, that seems a lot safer and a lot easier than to say, then, hey, I'd like to try a couple's vibrator. You know, it's kind of like, oh, I read this. This is intriguing. Should we go shopping together? Wouldn't that be fun? You know, Valentine's Day's just next month. So this is the time to get
I think
busy.
That's when this is going to probably come out around in February, probably yeah. for that reason.
Well, so, you know, forget the chocolates and bring the lube, or bring the lube and the chocolates, but not the chocolate lube. Very high on the road.
No, I think this has been really insightful. I definitely learned a lot. I'm sure Kevin's learned a lot.
Absolutely.
And I think what's important that you said is, you know, I think it's a great opportunity to learn from each other. And sometimes listening to these kinds of things, reading about these things with your partner, breaks down that yeah. discomfort for communication that you maybe wouldn't bring up, or a topic you wouldn't bring up either way. Because I think there's something sexy about your partner reading about improving pleasure and your sexual yeah. relationship. And I think both partners can kind of just appreciate that. And that's something yeah. that's very cool. Yeah.
The other thing also, just to you know, put a button on that, is for couples that are having a really hard time just feeling like they're not communicating like they'd like to and getting that conversation going, that's what sex therapy is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I'm not a therapist, yep. I'm a gynecologist. And sex therapists, certified sex therapists, that's what they specialize in, is getting someone in the room and getting that dialogue going so that there mm-hmm. is an open communication. And this isn't like other kinds of therapy in that, you know, it's years and years and years mm-hmm. until you get from point A to point B. Sometimes it's literally two or three sessions of just talking about your sexual relationship, what's working, what's not, and how to make it better. And to have that facilitated by someone who has real expertise. And we're not talking sex coaches. That's not the same thing. We're talking about psychotherapists mm-hmm. who have a master's degree mm-hmm. and certification in sexual medicine. Those are the people that you want to see who can really help that conversation.
And we've been lucky, because we have already on our podcast put out two excellent sex mm-hmm. therapists. Obviously, your daughter, Rachel Czar, is one of them. She's fantastic, and you can find her in Chicago. And we've mm-hmm. also had on Dr. Lisa Paz a couple mm-hmm. times, who is my local sex therapist down here in South Florida. So, you know, there are some really excellent resources around, but you're right. You really have to look for them, right? You know,
my podcast that aired in mid-December was with Rachel, and it's what yeah. to expect when you have sex therapy. And I think for couples who are a little leery, take a listen. This is talk therapy. You leave your clothes on, and basically we kind of walk through exactly what to expect.
That's great. I'm gonna definitely direct a lot of my patients, because, you know, I think when I talk to my patients about, they're like, I'm like, you know, I think sex therapy is going to be really beneficial for you and your partner. I don't know if it's the word therapy or something that kind of, like, they're a little bit like, oh, I don't think we're there. So, you know, that sounds like a great resource. I'm going to have my patients definitely take a listen to that, because I think a lot of my patients who undergo sex therapy have so much benefits, and their relationship is so much better afterwards.
I find that I don't use the word sex therapy because that makes, to your point, people feel like, oh, I don't really want to have sex therapy. What I say is that we have therapists who have a particular expertise in training in couples and their ability to relate to each other sexually, because that just sounds friendlier.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not as daunting.
No. So, all right.
You know, they're picturing Masters and Johnson, you know, that someone's going to like watch them have sex or something. And that's not what sex therapy is.
No, definitely not. But all right, this has been so great, Dr. Stryker. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'll have you on again because this was really enlightening.
And you got to come on my podcast.
Absolutely, 100% down.
We'll set that up.
So before we end, where can our listeners find you on what's your social media, your website, you know, your books, your podcast? Tell us all about that.
My books, the Dr. Stryker's Inside Information series. And I have SexRx, Hormones, Health, and Your Best Sex Ever, which is intended for all ages. And then I have my perimenopause and menopause series, which includes Slip Sliding Away, Turning Back the Clock on Your Vagina, Hot Flash Hell, and Putting the O Back in Mojo, which is about postmenopause orgasm, is going to come out in spring 2023. My social media on Instagram is at Dr. Strike, Streich. And every place else is at Dr. Stryker. Don't ask how that happened. But I cannot change my Instagram. If anybody has a clue how, please tell me. And my website is drstryker.com.
Awesome. And the podcast?
The podcast is Dr. Stryker's Inside Information.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I want to thank our listeners, as always, for listening to Man Up, Doctor's Guide to Men's Health. As always, you can listen to all of our episodes on any podcasting platform, you know, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon now. You can also find all of our episodes now. We record on video. So if you're watching this, we always appreciate that. Subscribe on YouTube. You can find us on at the Man Up Pod on all social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, you name it. Kevin, what's our website?
Website is at www.themanuppod.com.
All right. For Kevin and Dr. Stryker, thanks for listening. Until next time, have a good one.